I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Jim Cunningham. Jim is the executive director of CCAP, which is Cincinnati's angel capital group. He's also the executive director of The Circuit. And Jim, why do you think we're seeing so many people want to jump on the entrepreneurial bandwagon these days?
Well, I think for a couple reasons. One, the internet in particular has opened up the world to so much change, so much innovation, that there's a chance now for people to really upend the cart in various industries and create disruptive new companies. In fact, to some extent, it's become the younger you are, the more you know. So it's really leveled the playing field, almost tilted it in favor of entrepreneurs.
A lot of structure around entrepreneurship now, isn't there? I mean, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of help that entrepreneurs can get as they're starting a business.
That's a big change. Certainly when some of our, you know, the Queen City Angels, which is who I manage, is a group of 50 plus investors, and most of them have founded companies 20, 30 years ago. Back then, you got your money from mom and dad and maybe the guys your dad played golf with, and that was about it. Then we came along in 2000. We were about the 70th group of individual investors around the country. There are now 350 plus. And following that, I think the states have realized, the governments realized they needed to promote new companies because you see the big ones shrinking or moving overseas to fulfill the Asian market and the like. And so you really need to create new jobs that'll stay in the region.
Do you think entrepreneurial mindset to become an entrepreneur, is that something you can actually be taught? Can you learn that in school?
I'm probably in the minority. I think you have to be born with a certain personality who can do that, self-confidence, willingness to take risk. But you can certainly polish that apple a lot in school. You know, all the smart entrepreneurs, when you hear them talk and you read about them, one of the first things they say is, I found every mentor I could find and got help from everybody I could find. So this one of the things about being an entrepreneur is not being so egocentric that you can't take advice. And so, yeah, I think to get advice from the professors and others is a big advantage. Certainly an entrepreneurship major, an entrepreneurship minor is good. A lot of times we see people with a technical major, whether it's biology or engineering or IT, and an entrepreneurship minor, and now they've got a subject they can focus their entrepreneurship on. Minor or major, I think there are a lot of things to learn from other people, because when you get out starting your own company, you don't have enough money to make all your own mistakes. You'll be broke before you get to this formula for success. So you need to get the advice from experienced people. And I think that's a big help. I think the smartest people network the most. Like, for example, Candace Klein, who started SomaLend, and she's a national celebrity now in peer-to-peer lending. But she came to every local event and talked to everybody and got advice from a lot of people when she was starting that business. And I think she's really a good example. And she's been to the boot camp, and she's going to run a panel at this boot camp.
Well, speaking of the boot camp, it's coming up on June 3rd and 4th.
June 3rd and 4th. We have our 13th annual entrepreneur boot camp. I'm happy to say we've educated 500 entrepreneurs now at these boot camps and continue to sell out every year.
And quickly, the contact information is?
www.thecircuit.net.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Jim Singler. Jim's a partner with the law firm of Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp, and Jim practices in the area of private client group. You specialize in estate tax. I know, Jim, we've worked together on clients. No one likes to think about dying, but certainly it's absolutely critical that people get their affairs in order while they're alive to avoid just a huge mess, and really so that their wishes can carry on after they're gone. You help people do that.
It is really important that people get their affairs in order prior to an emergency happening in a family. And I'd like to start off by talking about the most basic documents first, which are just healthcare directives, which involve a healthcare power of attorney and a living will. And the reason those documents are so important is you might have a loved one who ends up in the hospital incapacitated. They're not able to make healthcare decisions for themselves. Well, the healthcare power of attorney allows the person that's nominated in that document to make those healthcare decisions for him or for her. And in the event that you don't have something like that in place, well, then you've got to go to probate court, set up a guardianship. It can be very timely, it can be very costly, and there's a lot of attorney fees to be paid.
In our society today, when people are just living longer, It's critical that people take the time to put their wishes in terms of how they want their health care to be enacted while, if something happens, like you said, if they become incapacitated. It's critical they do that while they're still of good mind.
It is absolutely critical that people think about those sort of things and talk about those decisions with loved ones and make their wishes known. Everybody remembers the Terry Schiavo case, that's why it's important to set up a document like a living will. I prefer to call it a health care directive rather than a living will, because people think of a last will and testament, which of course disposes of your assets when somebody is deceased. But a living will says that in the event that you are permanently incapacitated, you're terminally ill, that you choose not to have a feeding tube and a ventilator. And some people may want the feeding tube and the ventilator, but it's so important to talk about those issues now so that your loved ones know what your intentions are.
What advice do you give to, say, an adult child, to start having those conversations with their parents?
It is extremely difficult for an adult child to start those discussions with mom or dad, because you certainly do not want to think about those issues. And some of the more difficult questions that my clients struggle with are items like organ donation. And those involve religious decisions. Those involve decisions over whether you want your body to be used for medical research. And there's no doubt that those are tough issues, but maybe an idea for an adult child is to just put mom or dad in touch with a professional who does this sort of work, so that the child does not have to have those discussions with mom or dad. The trained professional can start those discussions.
It's even more important when you're dealing with a family business, isn't it?
It's absolutely essential. With family-owned businesses, particularly families that have some people inside the business and others outside of the business, it is critical that those issues, including valuations and things of that nature, are looked at on an annual basis. You could have a situation where adult son is working in the business, it's everybody's intention that he is going to take it over, nobody documents this, and now everybody inherits an equal share, and son is left buying out his siblings even though they don't work in the business. And that can absolutely destroy a business. It can
ruin a family. It can destroy a family.
Absolutely.
That's why it's just critical. If folks would like to learn more about you, Jim, reach you at your law firm, Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp. What is your contact information?
My phone number is 513-639-3961. Or you can reach me on my email address, which is jsingler, S-I-N-G-L-E-R, at kmklaw.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Jim Singler. Jim's a partner with the law firm of Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp, and Jim practices in the area of private client group. You specialize in estate tax. I know, Jim, we've worked together on clients. No one likes to think about dying, but certainly it's absolutely critical that people get their affairs in order while they're alive to avoid just a huge mess, and really so that their wishes can carry on after they're gone. You help people do that.
It is really important that people get their affairs in order prior to an emergency happening in a family. And I'd like to start off by talking about the most basic documents first, which are just healthcare directives, which involve a healthcare power of attorney and a living will. And the reason those documents are so important is you might have a loved one who ends up in the hospital incapacitated. They're not able to make healthcare decisions for themselves. Well, the healthcare power of attorney allows the person that's nominated in that document to make those healthcare decisions for him or for her. And in the event that you don't have something like that in place, well, then you've got to go to probate court, set up a guardianship. It can be very timely, it can be very costly, and there's a lot of attorney fees to be paid.
In our society today, when people are just living longer, it's critical that people take the time to put their wishes in terms of how they want their health care to be enacted while, if something happens, like you said, if they become incapacitated. It's critical they do that while they're still of good mind.
It is absolutely critical that people think about those sort of things and talk about those decisions with loved ones and make their wishes known. Everybody remembers the Terry Schiavo case, that's why it's important to set up a document like a living will. I prefer to call it a health care directive rather than a living will, because people think of a last will and testament, which of course disposes of your assets when somebody is deceased. But a living will says that in the event that you are permanently incapacitated, you're terminally ill, that you choose not to have a feeding tube and a ventilator. And some people may want the feeding tube and the ventilator, but it's so important to talk about those issues now so that your loved ones know what your intentions are.
What advice do you give to, say, an adult child, to start having those conversations with their parents?
It is extremely difficult for an adult child to start those discussions with mom or dad, because you certainly do not want to think about those issues. And some of the more difficult questions that my clients struggle with are items like organ donation. And those involve religious decisions. Those involve decisions over whether you want your body to be used for medical research. And there's no doubt that those are tough issues, but maybe an idea for an adult child is to just put mom or dad in touch with a professional who does this sort of work, so that the child does not have to have those discussions with mom or dad. The trained professional can start those discussions.
It's even more important when you're dealing with a family business, isn't it?
It's absolutely essential. With family-owned businesses, particularly families that have some people inside the business and others outside of the business, it is critical that those issues, including valuations and things of that nature, are looked at on an annual basis. You could have a situation where adult son is working in the business. It's everybody's intention that he is going to take it over. Nobody documents this. And now everybody inherits an equal share, and son is left buying out his siblings, even though they don't work in the business. And that can absolutely destroy a business. It can
ruin a family. It can destroy a family.
Absolutely.
That's why it's just critical. If folks would like to learn more about you, Jim, reach you at your law firm, Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp. What is your contact information?
My phone number is 513-639-3961. Or you can reach me on my email address, which is jsingler, S-I-N-G-L-E-R, at kmklaw.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Jay Bauer. Jay is the Director of Business Development for Innovative Student Loan Solutions. And Jay, there are many students graduating about this time of year, many kids coming out of school with a lot of college debt, and just the price of college and the sticker shock that's associated with it's just outstanding right now.
It's a very timely subject. The cost of college since 1982 has gone up a staggering 439%, and in the United States, student loan debt is now over $1 trillion.
Some experts think this is the next bubble that's going to burst, where the housing credit card debt before.
The Department of Education is extremely fearful that long-term, student loan debt and delinquencies are going to skyrocket.
Unlike housing debt, you can't purge that debt through bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy is not an option. You can walk away from your house, but not your student loans. The burden is on the student to be fiscally responsible at this age is easier said than done when you're going to school. Long term, there's absolutely going to be a problem with being able to repay.
Well, there aren't that many options, but there are some. If you come out of school, don't have a job, or you get a job but it doesn't pay you enough. There are some options in terms of mitigating the payment, aren't there?
The ability to reduce your monthly student loan payment, there's multiple options, Tom, you're correct. There's different repayment plans, because when you get out of school, they'll start you on a 10-year standard repayment plan. There's not only ways to change what you're paying, but also extend the payment, but oftentimes it comes at a cost. Another way is if you're going into a nonprofit setting, there's the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which yields a lower monthly payment, as well as the incentive to get the remaining principal and interest on your federal student loans forgiven after 10 years.
And a student graduating today has how long until they have to start repaying?
When they graduate, when they were in half-time or full-time status or more, 6-month deferment on the majority of federal student loans before your first payment is due.
So let's just say someone is lucky enough to get a job straight out of school. They start working, in 6 months, these payments start coming due. What happens if they can't pay them?
If they cannot pay them, there are ways to temporarily defer payment or postpone payment during that time. And the way you do that, number one, it's through a deferment, an economic hardship deferment if your job's not making a whole lot of income. Or second is a forbearance, which all it is a temporarily postponement of payment. Interest does accrue during that time on a forbearance.
Is there an option where you can pay a percentage of the income that you do earn in terms of loan repayment?
There are income-based repayment or income-contingent repayments are the two most common repayment terms that are capped at the percentage of income you make. Income-based for most borrowers is capped at 15% of your income, as well as there's a pay-as-you-earn program that for certain borrowers is capped at 10%.
So I'm a student, or really a parent of a student as well. I realize that my child or myself can't pay the student loan debt that's coming due. Can your company, Innovative Student Loan Solutions, will you be able to help people sort through their options and then come up with a strategy?
Our primary focus are with those nonprofit employees or professionals that can maximize the public service loan forgiveness program for a strategy or roadmap, if you will. For those that have general questions, we can certainly advise them as far as what alternative repayment options may be out there.
If people would like information about Innovative Student Loan Solutions, your contact information is?
Toll free, it's 1-866-831-5564 or by email info@islonesolutions.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Jay Bauer. Jay is the Director of Business Development for Innovative Student Loan Solutions. And Jay, if you're a student, recently graduated, many of people are doing that right now, you've come out of the university or college, you have a degree, but unfortunately, your starting salary may not support your student loan payment. What do you do?
First solution is there's alternative repayment plans through the lender that you can utilize that can lower your payment versus simply not making a payment. And an additional solution that if you work for a nonprofit organization such as a nonprofit hospital, a school system, or any 501c3 organization, you may qualify for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which was established in 2007 and not only provides you with an immediate lower monthly payment, but also the opportunity to have a significant portion of those federal student loans forgiven after 10 years or 120 payments.
And really, there's lots of organizations that qualify for this program, aren't there, in the not-for-profit world?
It's a broad brush that's towards the good of public service, as well as if you're a nonprofit 501c3 entity. And one of the key distinguishing features of the program is you don't have to be a particular employee segment. So it's for all employees that are either going back to school or may have student loan debt.
So if you have a marketing degree, you can go work in business development for a not-for-profit and still qualify for that loan assistance.
Correct.
I don't think many people understand that or completely have understood how broad that opportunity is.
The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program was established in 2007, and it's been underutilized just because of the lack of awareness, the misconceptions that it's associated with the more well-known nursing loan forgiveness programs or the teacher loan forgiveness program. It also suffers from not having a strategy to be able to navigate the program for that 10-year period of knowing what it means for you specifically.
It sounds like it could be a real win-win because nonprofits need great minds too. And if you're a student who's coming out of a university with a ton of debt, you can't get a job that pays enough to pay your living expenses plus service your debt, this would be could be a win-win.
It's a win for the organization as far as getting the best candidate available, as well as a recruitment and retention benefit. And secondly, for the employee as relief in a monthly payment and the opportunity to mitigate the outstanding student loan debt.
The key, or one important factor at least, is that if the student works for that organization or a similar one for 10 years in that non-for-profit role, then the rest of their debt gets forgiven. So they've made lower payments for those 10 years, and then at the end of that time, the debt will be forgiven.
For federal student loans, it's essentially written off by the Department of Education for those federal student loans.
Are there any downsides that people should know about?
One of the things when we discuss with clients a student loan forgiveness strategy is it's 10 years of payments or 120 payments, and it's a commitment to stay in a nonprofit setting. Doesn't have to be the same one.
What happens if you go 5 years through this, then you decide, hey, I want to go work in a for-profit business. I want to make more money, whatever.
And all you're essentially doing is you're foregoing the student loan forgiveness that would have been eliminated, but any payments you've made previously do go towards paying down a certain portion of principal and interest, and you would go on to an amortization schedule that's either a standard to pay it off in 10 years or 20 or 30 years, depending on the amount of student loans that are outstanding.
So folks want to find out more about this, what's your contact information?
It's Innovative Student Loan Solutions, and it's 866-831-5564, or by email, it's info@islonesolutions.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, summer is right around the corner. I know our daughter, our senior, is just about to graduate from high school, and she's considering summer job opportunities. And this is what many parents right now are thinking about. And how do I use my child, teach them some life lessons about work, but also help me in my own business?
Well, it's always great for your child to have a job, whether it's working for you or working for someone else. But it may be wise to hire your child to be your employee.
There's a lot of tax advantages when you hire your child, because generally your child is going to be receiving money from you in one form or the other. And if there's a way that you can actually associate work with the money that you give your child, it's a win-win. You get to deduct the money that you pay your child for services that they render on behalf of your firm, and you teach them some financial and life lessons.
If you're an unincorporated business, there's even an exemption from Social Security tax, so the child gets a benefit in terms of a greater net pay.
And your child is able to earn several thousands of dollars before they even have to pay a dime of tax. So it really can make good sense to hire your child. Now, again, obviously, the compensation that you pay them has to be reasonable. You can't pay them an amount that you would not pay another third party.
And even before that, the child has to be a real employee. You can't just put them on the payroll and not have them show up. They actually have to be there, and whatever duties they're getting paid to do, they need to perform those duties. And they need, as you said, to be paid a reasonable amount for those duties.
When your child works for money, actually show them the withholding taxes, the federal withholding taxes that are going to be withheld from their wages, so that they can see what they're actually getting in terms of net pay. If they're making, say, $10 an hour, show them what that really is after tax. Use it as a chance to have discussions with them so that they can start learning that, because, you know, unfortunately, this is not taught in schools generally.
Another thing I thought you were going to say, what they need to learn is to put money in an IRA.
That's absolutely right, because that's another area that I believe that we should, as parents, teach our children early. You never get those early years back, the magic of compounding. And if you can show your child that if they work and they earn a few thousand dollars and they take some part of that, or if you match what they earn and put it into an IRA, especially if it's a Roth IRA, the numbers just grow astronomically because of their young age.
Because they're putting the money in now when they're, you know, 15 to 20 years old, and they're going to take it out 40 years later or longer, and the effect of compounding on a tax-deferred, or if it's a Roth, a tax-free basis, is tremendous.
That word compounding is something so many people, even adults, don't quite fully understand. And what happens is when you put the amount in early and it just grows over time, it's that element of time that allows the number to grow so much. You don't get the same benefit if you start even 5 or 10 years later.
I mean, at a 6% return, money doubles every 12 years. So if you wait 12 more years, that's like one whole half of the money that you would otherwise have, you won't have.
There are a couple of things you need to be considering, though, when you do pay your child from your business. Certainly, they're going to have to file a tax return. That would be one thing. The other thing is, if your child is going to be eligible for financial aid, their own earnings may hurt them, or in terms of minimizing the amount of financial aid that they would otherwise be eligible for. Bottom line is, use the summertime work experience when your child works in your business to be able to leverage tax deductions, minimize your own company's tax, while using it as an opportunity as a financial education for your child. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, those lazy, hazy days of summer are right around the corner, and this is the time of year when many working parents wonder what they're going to do with their children all summer long while they're out of school.
Well, that's true, especially if you have not had daycare in your home or in a facility. You probably don't have daycare arranged. So many parents put their kids into a summer day camp.
They do, and summer day camps are great fun for the child, and you can potentially get a tax deduction, a tax credit, for the cost of the day camp if your child qualifies.
And generally, if the child is under 13 and both parents work or go to school full time and are otherwise qualified for the child care credit, then the day camp or summer camp will qualify as a qualifying expense.
And again, this is day camp. Overnight camps don't count. So if you are sending your child even to a soccer clinic or a basketball clinic, those types of camps may qualify for the child care credit. So you don't want to overlook that. Also nannies, I mean, more traditional daycare and child care counts too. But I think a lot of people don't realize that the costs of camps, maybe an art school or something like that, that they use for child care while the child's learning something, may also still qualify.
Well, and the credit can be fairly substantial. It can be at least 20% of the cost of the camp.
And it applies if you have one or two or more children. So there is some benefit, some real benefit, if you have multiple children going to the camps as well. If you're married, you must generally file a joint return to be able to take the tax credit. You cannot file married filing separate and be able to claim it. And that credit is computed on tax form 2441.
Well, and it's also important to point out that if you have a dependent care plan through your employer,
like a flexible spending account,
you can't spend money through that and get the credit, although generally those accounts are limited to $5,000. So if you have more than $5,000 of expenditures, you can still get some amount of credit for expenditures above that.
Up to $1,000, because the full amount is really capped at $6,000 for two or more children. You can find more information about the child care credit or dependent care credit by looking at IRS publication 503, and you can find that online at www.irs.gov. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, many people wonder whether or not they're saving enough for retirement. And for most people, the answer is no, unfortunately.
Well, that's right. And the other question they ask is, should I start saving for retirement? And the answer to that one is yes. No matter how old you are, the answer is yes. If you have any money, any income, then you need to start figuring out how you can save some of it. Even if you're spending every penny that you make now, figure out what you can cut back on so that you can pay some of your paycheck into a retirement fund.
Well, that's real easy to say, Tom, but it's very difficult for people to actually start execute on. So what's the very first thing people should do?
Well, they need to allocate a portion of their paycheck to their retirement savings. If they have a 401k plan or some other type of qualified plan at work, then they need to direct some amount of money to that. And each year when they get raises, when they get bonuses, they need to increase that percentage. So they take a part of their increase and allocate it to retirement. If you don't have a retirement plan, you can still set up an investment account and allocate part of your paycheck to that, have it directly taken out. Otherwise, it won't be around to the end of your pay period.
Our generation, and maybe our children's generation as well, will be the first ones to really have experienced what it's going to feel like not to have a lot of money in retirement, because most of our parents worked for a company 40 years and got a pension. Nowadays, most companies don't have pensions, so it's up to people to set aside money so that they can retire if they want to live in anywhere close to the way that they have lived their whole life.
I thought you were going to say we were the generation that wouldn't get Social Security.
Well, we don't know about that, but hopefully we will get Social Security. Hopefully that's going to be fixed. But the reality of it is you can't rely on Social Security or really any other thing. I think that it's up to you to make sure that you've planned, you've set enough money aside. It's really your responsibility to make sure you have enough money in retirement.
Yeah, and just saving the money is a good step and the first step, but it's not the only step. You have to look at how you're investing that money. You know, if you're putting it all in cash accounts, money market funds, You're losing money on your investment, you know, after inflation.
But at the same time, you don't want to go out and gamble with your money either. You don't want to put all of your money in high-risk investments because that's high risk for a reason.
Generally speaking, high risk for most people means volatile. It may not mean low return.
You need a combination of different types of investments so that you achieve the financial goals that you're trying to do. And again, don't try to do this on your own. Go out and seek outside counsel, because you don't have time to make a mistake generally, especially if you're getting closer and closer to retirement.
In most cases, if you participate in an employer plan, they have professionals who will come in and do education that will help you make investment choices that make sense for your situation. And there's also a lot of online tools you can use.
There are online tools. But again, if you don't have the confidence that you are making all the right choices, go ahead and think about a plan, you still may want to run it by someone who is a professional.
And really doing a financial plan, figuring out how much money you need to save at the end of your working career so that you can live well in retirement, that might incentivize you to save money by itself.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Crystal, you know a topic that seems to come up more often lately is whether or not an individual that works for a business is an employee or an independent contractor. And the reason I think that's become more important is with healthcare reform and certain size businesses required to have healthcare coverage for all their employees or face a penalty, I think they're looking for ways to have less employees, and one is to characterize them as independent contractors. But it's not as simple as that, is it?
No, it's not as simple. And just having an agreement between a company and the, quote, independent contractor, basically stating that that individual is working in the capacity as an independent contractor instead of an employee, that's not good enough. Clearly, if the employer-employee relationship exists, if you are doing all the things or many of the things that most employers do when they have employees in terms of managing the employee, telling the employee when to come and go, providing the tools and the resources for the employee, then you know what? It's an employee.
That's true. But there are reasons that people are independent contractors and not employees. For instance, if they offer their services to multiple companies, that may be an indicator. And if they work out of their home or their own office versus the employers, that may be an indicator. There's actually about 20 factors that are looked at to determine whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor, and not any one factor governs. But it's the preponderance of the factors that weigh in your favor, whether you are an employee or an independent contractor.
And that's why this is such a hot area in terms of IRS scrutiny, because it's not black and white. It's not an objective test per se. There is some level of subjectivity that goes into it. One big factor is who bears the risk of profit or loss. So in essence, if you hire someone to perform a particular task, can that person make a profit? Can that person experience a loss? If the person's just going to get paid by the hour, regardless of the outcome, probably an employee.
Right. But you could be a commissioned salesperson. You still have that profit or loss factor, and you may still be an employee, depending on whether you're controlled by the employer or not. So there's a lot of factors involved. I think the IRS is probably going to look at this even closer in the future because of the healthcare aspect of this. If you do have a relationship with someone that you want to characterize as an independent contractor, I think it's very important that you document all the factors that go in your favor. While the contract won't control whether or not it's treated that way, you certainly want to have a contract and discuss it with your attorney and make sure that it indicates the relationship correctly.
And certainly another issue would be in terms of how you pay your worker, whether you pay them every week, every month, just like you do regular employees. Is it subject to a contract? Can the contract be terminated at any time?
Yeah. Do they submit an invoice? That's a good indicator.
Who sets the hours? Who bears the costs and the expenses of actually performing the service and any materials and supplies? As you mentioned, there are 20 factors. You can go to the IRS website at www.irs.gov and look for those 20 factors.
Or you can even submit a form and they'll give you an opinion as to whether your relationship qualifies as an employee or independent contractor one.
Just know that it can be tricky and the penalties are stiff and severe. So make sure that you have your ducks in a row so that you can avoid any tax impact that could potentially harm you and your business. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Crystal, we recently had a question on our tax chat about a Roth IRA, and the question was the listener had converted part of their IRA a couple of years ago when you could pay the tax on the conversion over a two-year period, and they wondered if they were still able to do that. And the short answer is no, you can't do the two-year spread, but you can still convert a Roth.
Yes, you can convert to a Roth from a traditional IRA. The key is that it just needs to make sense. It's just not something that everyone should do blindly. You have to really take a look at your situation, your age, when you might need the money, what your tax bracket is, how you'll get the cash to pay the tax, because there usually is some tax on the conversion.
The idea is that you pay the tax today on the value of your IRA when you convert it to the Roth. And then when you take it out, and hopefully many years later, you don't pay any tax again on that or the income it's earned. But it is one thing you said, it's nothing that you should do blindly. And of course, you shouldn't do it blindly. But if you did, you can undo it. That's one of the few things in the tax world that you can undo.
You can, as long as you do it by a certain deadline.
Right, by the time you file your tax return. So if you did a Roth conversion at the end of 2012, and for whatever reason determined that no longer made sense, then you can undo it and go back to the IRA without any penalty or tax consequence.
Again, as long as you do it prior to the time you file your 2012 return, including extensions.
That's right. And really, IRAs are a great thing for most people, whether it's a Roth IRA, and the benefit of the Roth IRA is you don't get a deduction when it goes in, but you don't pay tax on it when it comes out. There's a traditional IRA, which only certain people can get, but in a traditional IRA, you get a deduction when you put the money in, and you can get a deduction for that if you're not covered by another plan or if your income is below a certain amount.
And you can still make that contribution and get a deduction if you're eligible, as long as you do it prior to April 15th of this year. So certainly, if you can take advantage of that, that's one of those deductions that you can still do. It makes a lot of sense, and you want to take advantage of it if you can.
Well, it's always good if you can put money in an account that's in your name, and the government will pay you, in essence, a tax amount in order to do that. And really, hopefully, you've already done your 2012 IRA and have funded your 2013, which you could have funded starting January 1. And actually, you can put another $500 in 2013. So the limits are $5,500 for everyone and an additional $1,000 if you're age 50 or over.
Yes, and certainly the big reason to fund your IRAs early is because the money can start to accrue interest earlier. So effectively, you'll have more money at the time that you need to pull the dollars out for retirement. And back to your point, Tom, I love the idea that the IRS has given us a tax deduction to help fund dollars for our retirement. It's just a great deal.
Well, and IRAs are great, but they can complicate your life. And not only are there questions about how much money to put in and how to do it, but people who are at the other end of the spectrum when they reach retirement age have to think carefully about how they take their money out of the IRAs. And if you do have both a Roth and a traditional IRA, with the Roth being non-taxable when the distributions come out, it gives you more flexibility in terms of the distributions that you need during retirement.
And not to complicate things, but I will mention this. If you are not eligible for a Roth and you can't get a deduction for a traditional IRA, you can still make a contribution to a traditional IRA. You just can't take the deduction. It can be complicated, but in the end, it's worth it. It just makes sense to take a look at your own situation and see which type of IRA is best for you. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.